Hello, and welcome to episode 22 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man, and my name is Graham Lee. Now, today's episode features one simple request. Developers, please attend more meetings. Now, that's probably going to ruffle a few feathers, and you need a little bit of defence, so let's jump in. Now, when I say please attend meetings, I probably want you to go to more meetings than you expect, but not as many as you fear. You probably have this expectation of only being able to grab 15 minutes here and there throughout your day because your calendar has become the manager's schedule and is dotted with various meetings. That would probably be overkill for a lot of us, but the meetings that we do need to go to are incredibly valuable, will help us do better work, and are perhaps more numerous than we credit. If you aren't attending meetings, then you aren't actually doing your job as a professional programmer. What you're doing is monetizing your hobby as a person who likes to write software for a computer. So that is the reason I want you to attend meetings, and now the rest of the episode will be justifying that position. And I'm going to take a historical perspective on this. The old way of working in software, the thing that we were all doing before the Agile Alliance came along with their manifesto, and you know, the frameworks like Scrum came along, and certainly way before people were talking about ideas like DevOps. The old way was not actually the waterfall model as presented, you know, not this idea of no returning, ever progressing phases, but certainly a phased and mostly linear approach to project management that was designed around infrequent but incredibly heavyweight meetings. And so Agile wasn't a response to there are too many meetings, we need to get our work done. Agile was a response to the meetings we are having are not helping us do better work. I worked in an organization that had a waterfall process, and in many organizations that claimed to be agile but were sort of partway through an agile transition before they got stuck and reverted to some of their previous practices. Whether or not they would have benefited from a by the book, to the extent that there is a book definition of agile, they certainly weren't reaping all of the benefits of a more flexible approach and a more upfront approach to change management. So the one place I worked that had what was definitely an observable waterfall process that nobody would disagree with, that it was a waterfall, was a context where nobody on the project team could get any work done, they could get work done within a particular phase. They couldn't make progress between phases, so you couldn't decide that design was complete and that you were going to do some development now without going through a phase exit meeting. And at the phase exit meetings, the senior management of this company, which was a medium-sized business, 500-ish people, so the senior management had to be convinced that everything had been done for the previous phase and that all of the risks had been mitigated for the next phase, and they had to sign off on all of the activities being complete, which meant a lot of wasted effort in terms of project management collateral. You know, when we say we value working software over comprehensive documentation, what we mean is that the software working has more value than documentation that claims that the software is working. Not that you shouldn't document your software, because of course documentation in that sense is an output and something that enables the customer to derive value from the software. So we're not saying you shouldn't document your APIs, or you shouldn't produce user manuals and things. What we're saying is, I don't care whether the effort that went into producing that project collateral, but also there's a lot of schedule slippage just due to the fact that, you know, you're trying to ask people who are three levels up from you in a hierarchy to all be in the same room at the same time so you can have your phase exit meeting. And you know, the demand on their time was very high because they had to be in every phase exit meeting of every project that was going on in the whole company. So, you know, that was a cause of schedule slippage, but a much more frequent and egregious cause of schedule slippage was discovering at a phase exit that the work for the phase hadn't been done satisfactorily, or that the work done during the phase which had been done satisfactorily had uncovered problems that nobody had felt empowered to change until the correct people were in the room, by which we mean the people who were allowed to make the decisions in the phase exit meeting. So there was a long lag between discovery and fix of problems. And so, you know, a particular thing that happened on this project was that the three developers, myself included, were all very inexperienced. One was a developer with about 5 years of experience who had never worked on the target platform before and didn't understand its APIs, its programming language, or, you know, or even the design of its graphical user interfaces. One was me, who was experienced at that stuff but had never worked as a commercial programmer before. And the third was a fresh graduate who had neither of those experiences. So we would frequently produce code that was so defective that it generated more work in fixing bugs than the time we had spent on creating it. What that meant was that the scheduled date was, the shipping date was inexorably moving into the future, because every time we did one day of work, we generated another 3 days of work for ourselves. Now, on a modern project, we would discover that within 1 to 2 weeks, because we would say, how did you progress on this sprint? Well, I've only done 1/3 of the work, and the QAs have sent it back with three times as much bug fixing to do. Okay, you need training. In fact, we'd discover it quicker than that, because we would have our daily stand-up and we would say, how is that story progressing? Well, I'm not sure I know what to do. And, you know, okay, well, you know, maybe you need some training. Best cases, within a day we would discover that the team is out of their depth, and the worst cases is within a fortnight. But on this project, even if you could see that that was going wrong earlier, you couldn't commit to making any changes about it until it got to a sort of point of no return very late into the project. So that is the reason that the Agile Alliance came together, many of whom already had their existing lightweight processes. You know, what the story about the history of the Agile Manifesto is that Robert Martin invited all of these people to a conference in Chicago to discuss lightweight methods. And Alistair Coburn, who'd created the Crystal project methodology, said, I don't want to be known as one of the lightweight software experts. We need another name. And everybody agreed that nobody wanted to go to Chicago anyway. So they went to a ski resort in Utah and brainstormed the name Agile. So the whole point of Agile was a reaction to that kind of process and to that kind of decision making. You find these things out earlier and you make them cheaper to correct And the way you find them out earlier is by having the meetings earlier and more frequently and discussing whether the software that's being delivered by the various technical people on the team meets the expectations of the customers, the people who are running the sort of sales and marketing functions of the business, and the people who are eventually going to use this software, because the software is an artifact that is going to be delivered into a system that is not necessarily the populated by the developers. It's populated by other people. We have to find out what impact that software is having and will have on that system. And the Agile Alliance was fighting for an equal seat at that table, at the decision-making where we uncover how the software can best be developed in the sort of loose sense, extended, changed, reduced, whatever needs to happen, in order to make the technical expertise an equal peer to the domain expertise and the business expertise in the enterprise of writing software. So what the sort of ideology that led to the waterfall-like project I described earlier was an ideology where developers and testers and build experts and sysadmins and so on are like grunt workers, where they are people who you give money to in exchange for them giving you their labour power. And it was managed in a very sort of Taylorian approach to management science. What are the conditions we need in order to make these people more productive, in order to get more code per hour out of our software engineering team? And so you'd see things like lines of code per hour, which of course is a metric that doesn't really work, because sometimes you need to delete or modify lines, not add lines, or code points per hour, things like that. Not how much are these people contributing to the success of this organization. So what that means, the very principle of the Agile Alliance, of these people who came together to pool their understanding of what were comparatively lightweight software project methodologies in order to be seen as professional contributors to the production of software, rather than as hired muscle in the typing out of the codes, is that if we've learned from these people and if we've adopted this way of working, then the way that we work in 2020 should be that we collaborate as peers with the domain experts and with the people who are like planning and operating the business to understand the context and the problem and design and implement a solution. And we should do so collaboratively and iteratively. Now, the context is the scenario into which the software will be deployed on the one hand. So, the people who are going to use it, the people who are engaging in processes that are mediated by the software, the people who are interacting with the people whose work or leisure or whatever is going on is directly affected by the software. And also the capabilities of the team delivering the software. And this is where the sort of project management aspects of Agile come into play. There is an interplay between what are the important things that the customer wants now, and what is this team capable of delivering in a short term? And given the the conflict between those two things, or the synergy between those two things, what should we focus on in order to maximise the confluence of what the people are capable of and what the context requires. The problem, so I said that we collaborate with the main experts and business experts on understanding both the context and the problem. The problem is in like line of business software sense, the inefficiency or incapability that will be removed by successful software delivery. So it is a problem that the software will solve, or it is a thing that we can't do that because we have the software we will be able to do, or it is a thing that we can't do well that the software will help us do well, or a thing that we can't do much of that the software will help us do more of. Obviously, like, you know, in the context of a game, the language of defining the problem is very different. The problem is that people aren't sufficiently entertained, and that this software should be entertaining to them. But I want to focus more on sort of line of business software, and I'm using business in a very broad sense, because, you know, this could be research software where the line of business is actually the production of novel knowledge and not the completion of a business process. Or it could be charity work where the problem is the delivery of some benefit to society rather than the delivery of some like valuable commodity to some consumers. Nonetheless, that broad brush definition of a problem, an inefficiency or incapability that will be removed by the application of software, that is the working definition that we're going to go with. So we're going to understand these two things, the context and the problem. We're going to use that collaboratively derived understanding to create a solution. And the solution is the combination of the software delivered and the changes to the processes and people in the context caused by the software's existence that together contribute to lessening this inefficiency or providing this capability. Now that is critical and goes a long way to explaining why successful software is iteratively, incrementally, and evolutionarily delivered, because the act of solving the problem changes the context and the problem. Maybe it introduces new problems, but backgrounds other problems. Maybe it changes the importance of existing problems that were already present. Maybe it causes different people to be involved. You know, maybe we now need more IT people and fewer typists, for example. Whatever it is, introducing the software changes the shape of the problem that the software itself solved, which therefore means more development, and it means more collaborative understanding of the problem domain, because the problem domain just changed. So you're only going to build the right thing if you have an up-to-date understanding of what you're trying to build and for whom, and also why. You know, like why this particular problem and why those particular people. And those are sort of the business answers. You know, your business will have some kind of mission. Maybe it's, so here's a good example. I worked for a financial technology company where our stated mission, like the purpose of the business, was to take the financial advice that was already successfully being given to high net wealth individuals, so basically like rich middle-aged white dudes with yachts, and bring that down through the sort of middle social classes, so to people who had enough money to worry about how to invest their money, but not enough money that it was just a game and that they could afford to, like, you know, spaff thousands of pounds on meeting a financial advisor to work out how to save them tens of thousands of pounds. Yeah, this was more about taking people who are in salaried positions, who have a pension plan, and like their pension plan is their principal asset and their mortgage is their principal liability, and making sure that these two things are going to meet in the middle somewhere before they retire. So there's your mission, like expand access to good financial advice. The product that we were working on did not fulfill that mission. It was a product for the people who were giving out the financial advice to the high net worth individuals to improve the reliability of the record of the advice they had. It was essentially a tool that would enable them to do audits more efficiently. Now, the design goal of the software had been to automate it so that it could be, you know, so that the delivery of the advice could be scaled up. The software implemented that design goal. It automated the delivery of the advice. So what had gone wrong? The software developers hadn't understood the context, including the business context, which is what shaped the execution of the mission, where the salespeople were motivated to find large customers who were easy to sell to, who tended to be the advisors who had a lot of high net worth individuals on their books because they had more income and could, you know, spend more of it on speculative software that might improve their processes. So all of these three things have to come together for the software to be successful. And the only way that they're going to come together is if you take a seat at the table. And the only way that you're going to take a seat at the table is to turn up to the meetings where these things are discussed. It's as simple as that. Also, the people who are on the domain expertise side and the business expertise side, the people bringing those skills to the collaboration, will only have an understanding of what's feasible, affordable, achievable, within like the resources and time constraints that the business has, with input from those who know what the software delivery team, the software engineering people, are capable of doing within the time and the resources available, and who have an understanding of how that fits into the sort of strategic design, the architecture of the software system. So if you don't have the software people attending the meetings, what you will get is a situation that I've actually often seen in software companies, where the software developers are increasingly frustrated with the increase in feature requests coming from the business, in finger quotes, and are increasingly frustrated at the lack of time or opportunity given for engineering tasks in equal quote fingers, such as, you know, dealing with technical debt. If they're not involved in the decision making, then there's no reason why anyone would know that the features being requested are infeasible, or that the maintenance of the existing product is the thing that is taking up all of the engineering time. If you're not involved in those discussions, there's no reason to believe that they would involve your input. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. But I get the whole, like, make a schedule, manage a schedule thing. I referred to it at the top of the show. This idea that knowledge workers benefit from large periods of interrupted time, large periods of uninterrupted time, and that managers tend to be on a more sort of a la carte schedule, slicing their time up into various small periods and choosing to switch between different contexts in faster chunks, and that these two schedules are incompatible. There's a couple of secrets you need to know. The first is that actually, for most line of business software, the sort that I'm talking about, where it deals with a process problem, an inefficiency or a lack of capability, you don't actually need flow state to develop it. There shouldn't be a whole lot of like deep knowledge work involved. It's not complex enough to need that sort of purely technical research that comes from being in the flow state and from focusing on the coding, which is the implementation of the software design, to the exclusion of everything else. And indeed doesn't benefit from it, because if you're doing that, then you're not understanding the line of business that this line of business software should be addressing. You're wiring up UI bindings, making state changes to a database, making like API calls and putting some validation on the inputs, implementing sort of simple business constraints. There's not really a lot in there that needs deep work. And, you know, I will apply that quite fairly to a lot of the software that I've written in my career. I mean, the projects I'm working on now, they may be for a university, they may be research software, and that research may be publishable, but to a large extent the research is in what data do we need to keep, and what are the consistency rules. And then once you know that, once you've actually designed the interaction and understood the people and what they need out of it, the actual like building of the software is not too complex. So you don't actually need the flow state. There are some like bigger tasks, sure. Like there are things that are going to need quite a bit of effort. Such as when you get measurable performance problems, you need to spend some deep time diagnosing them, or like integrating with, say, hardware. Thing where there's a well-specified problem that is going to take a big chunk of time to solve. And like, even there are coping strategies that allow you to lose less time, losing the time is the wrong way to look at it. They allow you to be more efficient at translating from a non-programming context to a programming context, and they basically come down to documentation, not of the project collateral kind that I was talking about earlier, but of information about your tasks that you leave for yourself, so that you don't have to try and understand your task again when you come back to it. Simple things like to-do lists, open tests, by which I mean tests where you have captured the requirement but not made it pass. Just like having a lab book, effectively, like a journal that you keep of what you're doing, so that when you leave, you have a record of where in the problem-solving state you had got to, allow you to re-enter that state very quickly. In fact, you may not even need to read your documentation, because the act of writing the documentation has reinforced in your memory the location that you got to, and the thought process you were having as you arrived at the point of recording that information in your log. And of course, when they are on teams of more than one person, there's the option of sharing the work, by which I mean sharing both the meeting attendance work, or the like interesting and beneficial work, as I like to call it, and the technical sort of coalface coding work. Not just have one delegated meeting attendee, which is often how teams do it. They'll have like a manager or a scrum master or something who is expected to sort of go to all of the meetings and then collect the information together and trickle it out to the rest of the team. And I have been that manager, and I have failed in that role, because often your sort of précis of all of the meetings you've gone to, your little abstract of of what you think the person needs to know based on all of the things you've been told in all of the meetings, is incomplete. And so they end up missing important information, which they would have found if they had gone to the meeting. So sharing that information around and then having a way to internally broadcast it within the team can definitely help. Making sure that there isn't just one person who has all of the meeting attending responsibilities. Another secret is that you don't need to be in all meetings all the time. You know, we don't need to talk about the manager's schedule where you're trying to find half an hour to get some work done in the middle of your 7.5 hours of meetings in your 8-hour day. And this is just basic meeting attendance stuff and basic sort of meeting etiquette that perhaps people who have been on the manager's schedule are more likely to understand and to know than people who are trying to keep themselves on the maker's schedule. So things like making sure that when you're invited to a meeting, there's an agenda so you can see what is going to be discussed and whether it's relevant to you, and have the option to delegate things to someone who would be more appropriate to attend, or decline the attendance to something that you think doesn't need your input and that you won't learn things from. Making sure that actions are recorded in the minutes and then summarized. And like, this is one of the things that actually Confluence, the Atlassian wiki, does very well, is that it can you can write meeting minutes with like named actions, and then they appear as a to-do list for the for each attendee. Gets their own list of actions, and that can be seen in a single place. So you've got this kind of GTD style approach where all of your actions from various places are being organized as a to-do list. And as I say, having that to-do list makes it easier to find out what your context needs to be when you get back to the work. Making sure that there's a schedule and that you stick to that schedule. Now, that can be uncomfortable if you're like in the middle of a deep discussion, it gets to the end of the time, you say I've got to go back to work, but people are going to want to carry on that discussion. You need to make clear that you want to carry on the discussion, but you have other things to do. And it can be as simple as saying, so which of these things would you prefer me not to do? And then having the discussion over whether to continue the meeting now or to reschedule the rest of the discussion for another time. Sometimes that can be beneficial because it gives everyone else time to reflect on the content of the discussion and maybe discard some ideas that were like being debated in the heat of the moment, or to see the other person's point of view. Eventually, normalizing the idea that a meeting needs to be held to its schedule normalizes the idea that someone needs to run the meeting to the schedule, eventually meetings become it's not quick, because you're basically enacting culture change, and so you need to bring the sort of the norm of the collection of all of the people who are involved from wherever it is to wherever you're trying to get it. And that is a slow and continual process, not a sudden process. But getting it in place means that people will be more likely to engage in meetings where they know that there is a fixed time and an expectation of coming to a conclusion, that is having actions that are related to the items on the agenda within that time. Like I say, this is all like basic how to run a meeting stuff. The only problem is that programmers, because they often have an aversion to meetings, don't actually understand the like rules and etiquette of running meetings well, and so every meeting they go to is a bad meeting, and so it puts them off going to more meetings, and so they do worse work. Now, of course, some meetings can indeed be emails or instant messages, but If you're going to rely on that comeback, then you need to make sure that you're responsive to emails and instant messages. You need to put time into your day for responding to those things thoughtfully, considerately, and reading them and taking that information in. And you know, some things are not going to be conducive to offline discussion. Sort of quick rule of thumb is that the more contentious something gets, the more likely it is it'll actually benefit from face-to-face meeting, because then you get all of the emotional and social cues of the conversation, and you're more likely to get to a satisfactory resolution than if you try to have a combative argument over the internet. And anyone who's ever read the comments on a site like Hacker News will understand the problem of not having emotional context in a discussion that people are getting invested into. So here's my rule of thumb. A person who doesn't go to meetings will produce lower quality code than a person who does go to meetings, despite the maker schedule management schedule, despite having more time for writing code, and despite having longer in the flow state, because the person who went to the meetings knows what the software is supposed to do in a way that the person who doesn't go to the meetings doesn't have as deep a knowledge of. As always, I welcome feedback on these podcasts. They are for your benefit, not so much for mine, although I do benefit from getting these ideas out and enjoy working with the community on making software better and on making it faster and easier to make software better. So email grahamlee@acm.org, tweet iwaslg, iwaslg. Thank you very much for your time, and I will talk to you again.